Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to Off the Charts, a podcast that brings you in-depth analysis and insights on one OTC-listed company each week. I'm your host, Phil Carroll, and joining me are my co-host, Kevin Hornsby, and our resident analyst and investor, Charles Archer. Together, we'll explore the exciting world of emerging companies and the opportunities they present. Welcome back, Jen. So, episode two, how is everyone?
I'm feeling fantastic. Yeah. How are you, Phil?
A bit more enthusiastic than last time, Charles.
I'm super good and getting better.
Well, we're all optimistic. It's sunny outside. I think that's helped a lot.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, sunny outside, but not wasn't sunny in Pennsylvania this week, was it? Obviously, the big news of the week was the Trump assassination attempt, which then spawned effectively what was the perfect campaign poster. And then obviously we've seen Joe Biden with COVID and I'm feeling very sorry for himself. What do you make of that story this week? I mean, obviously dominated world headlines. We're based in the UK and we saw nothing but the social media obviously lit up with that story.
I think the first thing to say is a man in Pennsylvania who lost his life, you know, in amongst the headlines, you know, people potentially, you know, haven't paid attention to this, but somebody died at a political rally. That awful news personally, but also on a political level, really bad for the US. For Trump, you know, potentially this will maybe, you know, a wake-up call, not just for him, but for, you know, all sides of the politicians to say, look, we need to step back on this divisive rhetoric and, you know, maybe focus a bit more on what binds us rather than what divides us. And then in terms of politically, obviously, potentially Biden stepping down. And that photo of Trump doing the fist pump, or even the clip with the American flag in the background, literally bleeding to the country. In my mind, that he sealed the deal electorally in that moment, and yet in the most awful way possible.
Yeah. And how does it have any sort of change the outcome of any presidential campaign and the election? What do you think Trump that's a winner shot for him now?
Yeah, it must be. I mean, the interesting question will be how we want to go too political because this is the US, but how this affects the gun control debate, if at all. Because on the one hand, Trump is a Republican, he's pro-guns, he's not for gun control at all. And on the other, he almost lost his life to a sniper. So how you reconcile those two things will be very interesting.
I mean, a lot of the argument I've seen on that side of things, on the old the arms, is that, oh, well, banning them now won't make any difference because there's so many guns out there. There's like two guns per person or something.
Yeah, or three or four or something, yeah. But then Australia had the similar amount, and they saw the guns all handed in. The UK had less, admittedly, but you know, we are after the Dunblane disaster. You know, I said disaster, massacre. We handed our guns in, apart from rifles and shotguns. In America, I think it's different because it's a much younger country, and they haven't quite decided what their national identity is. It seems more like a proliferation of states rather than, you know, a united country. But I think, you know, as a first step, to me, it seems crazy that you should be licensed to hold firearms in the same way as you should be licensed to drive a car. It doesn't take away your right to own a car, but you should be, at the very least, I know how to shoot guns. Most people in the UK don't know how to shoot guns, and yet you can go to America and pick up pretty much anything you want.
That's $3,000 to $3,500 will buy you an AR-7, you know, an assault rifle.
I've seen people, at the rifle range or, you know, out in the country and, like, they have no gun safety awareness whatsoever, couldn't hit a target at 100 metres to save their lives. You know, actually, maybe, you know, the first thing you should do is say, if you want to own a gun, you need to pass the gun test, a really basic, like a driving test, that shows you're capable of using it safely. Because more people die in accidental shootings than they do in on-purpose shootings in the US.
Absolutely. So, And how do you think, you know, we've seen Obama effectively moving against Biden. We've seen Biden in quarantine in the White House this week. Obviously, we alluded to the fact that he potentially has picked up another strain of COVID. He's not getting any younger. The suggestions that he may step aside and involve 25th. Do you think that that's likely to pan out in the next week or two?
I really hope so, not just for the country's sake, but for Biden's sake. He's lost his mind. He's got dementia, and I think even if you were to, if he he's coming to the end of this term now, but can he really do another 4 or 5 years? You know, just zero chance of that. He needs to go now, and there's just enough time to put somebody else in place and to campaign. But I think even people who are Democrat and who support Democrats along party lines will struggle to vote for Biden, given his mental decline. It's as simple as that, really. So what will happen is Trump will win because the Democrat voters won't turn out if Biden is the candidate. It's as simple
Yeah.
as that.
So obviously,
who's been running the United States of America for the last 2 years?
You know, I think potentially Obama, to be honest. And given this move against Biden, I wonder whether, you know, Obama is essentially trying to get his fourth term now. But it potentially isn't just the deep state, you know? It feels a little bit conspiracy theory level. But it's very clear that Biden is not the one calling the shots. And anyone with a brain can look at the footage, which is all publicly available, and look at it and go, yeah, there's no chance that this man is the one with his finger on the nuclear button. Just zero. What do you think, Phil?
Yeah, I'm not sure who's running it, but it certainly doesn't appear. I mean, you look at we were talking about this, like, you know, the whole Donald Trump thing now, and whether this event that happened would actually change his demeanor, his attitude, let's say his humility, because in the UK it certainly feels like he just attacks people. He doesn't have a lot of respect for them. But I think from what I've seen from Milwaukee, and he did a speech. He did his first kind of rally, didn't he, in Milwaukee, where he's really spoken about the incident, and he did seem to have a little bit more compassion and humility. Obviously, he paid tribute, as you alluded to at the top there, Charles, to Corey, the veteran who passed, unfortunately, in the attempt. And I just wonder now whether you know, it's going to change Donald Trump. But in terms of voting for him, I do feel like he's now got the upper hand, and I think that he's changed. Public opinion of him will change. Not necessarily a sympathy vote, but I think he will go up in the polls now.
So let's see what happens next. I think that in America, the one thing that unites people is patriotism. We don't really have patriotism in the UK anymore, it seems.
Well, I mean, you watch these rallies and you see them, the passion that these and this
Yeah.
patriotism they have for this, that the fist bumping, the shouting. I mean, what do you make of his latest kind of, I wouldn't say a slogan, but his fight, fight, fight that he's been doing, and the fist pumping? Do you think this is an act of aggression?
I think it, you know, after the January the 6th demonstrations, you know, like I think he should be more careful about what he does. And to be fair, exactly the same on the other side of the camps, not a party political point. But I think that when you compare to the UK, for example, yes, Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak in our recent election kind of threw a bit of mud at each other. But Rishi Sunak is still in Parliament. Keir Starmer's, you know, got a whacking great majority is in charge. After, you know, at the end of the day, they walk off together. They'll perfectly happily have a couple of drinks in the House of Commons bar, you know, and talk about day-to-day politics, especially given, you know, given that Labour's got such a big majority, they're not threatened by the Conservative Party at the moment. But you compare that to the Democrats and to the Republicans. Can you imagine Joe Biden and Donald Trump having a few drinks and just like shooting the breeze? Like, no chance. You know, you couldn't imagine that,
I'm
could you?
not sure Joe would find the bar, to be honest with you.
No, and if he did one drink, he'd be
But
down like a breeze. But
let's move on to our guest this week. We're joined by Sean Wade, CEO of Power Metal Resources, listed under the ticker POWMF on the OTCQB. Power Metal Resources is a metals exploration company focused on financing and managing global resource projects seeking large-scale metal discoveries. The company targets district-scale potential across a diverse global portfolio, including precious, base, and strategic metals in North America, Africa, Saudi Arabia, and Australia. The projects range from early-stage exploration to advanced prospects under drilling. Power Metals develops projects internally or through strategic joint ventures, aiming to dispose of them via sale or separate listing, thereby realizing value. Proceeds from disposals are reinvested for growth or returned to shareholders through buybacks, dividends, or in-specie distributions. Power Metals has a large portfolio of assets, including PowerArabia, uranium assets, and let's not forget the company has caught the attention of renowned investor Rick Rule. Welcome, Sean.
Hi, Phil. Thanks very much for having me.
Absolutely. So, Sean, do you want to just talk us through the Power Metals model, please?
Yeah, so I think you summarized it very well. And, you know, what we are trying to do is to incubate these mining projects. And I think I'd probably draw, and you mentioned Rick Rule, which is very important, because not only is Rick an important shareholder for us, but you know, we also attend his important symposium event, which is happening in Florida next week, so which I'm going to be at. But he was also in London this week, and we had a chance to catch up with him and be able to publish an interview with him, and where he talks very specifically about what he calls the merchant banking model in natural resources. And he says, look, you know, lots of people do this. Robert Friedland does this. Brian Lundin does this. And, you know, to be mentioned in the same sentence as those two was obviously great, you know, very flattering for us, because, you know, obviously they've got this incredible track record. But, you know, fundamentally, the point that he's making is, look, and this is what he did for very many years, mostly in the unlisted world, as it happens, you know, mostly in sort of, you know, private, in a private context. But he said it's about deploying capital, and it's about turning that relatively modest capital deployment into a much, much bigger return. And I think he said on the interview we did, you know, if Sean deploys 10 million and he gets 2 million back, then I'm going to fire him by selling my shares in the market. He should be doing the opposite way around and deploying relatively small amount of money, adding value to what he's doing, and then making a good return. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk about the assets, but, you know, that's exactly what we're about to hopefully do with our uranium assets in Athabasca. So the idea is that essentially we have a certain amount of capital from the market. We've talked a bit before, I think, haven't we, about, you know, the cost of that capital, and we don't necessarily need to go over that again. But, you know, fundamentally, we take investor capital, we invest it in early stage exploration through methodical and cost-effective techniques. That can be geochemistry, geophysics, and some early stage drilling. We look to monetize that by essentially, hopefully, making commercial discoveries, or at least, you know, getting towards those discoveries, such that we've added value to our portfolio. And then how do we then seek to monetize that? And that can be through spin out IPOs, which we've done in very successfully in the case of Golden Metal Resources, soon to be renamed Guardian Metal Resources. We are in the process of doing with First Development Resources in Australia, where we're doing in a slightly different way through the Athabasca portfolio with a joint venture with a globally significant investor, or in other ways where we, you know, like with First Class Metals, where we vended in some assets into a vehicle that will then subsequently IPO'd, where we're relatively small shareholder in that case, around 25%. So there's lots of ways of monetizing it, but fundamentally, it's about this kind of corporate finance activity, capital markets activity, or merchant banking, as Rick calls it, which is to say a portfolio of projects with good network relationships with capital markets and investors, such that we can bring the capital in, make the return, and then deliver those returns to our shareholders. So that's really the kind of essence of the model and the message we want to get across to people. The difficult part is, how do you value that? And you know, and Charles, you know, has done some really, really helpful and fantastic work on this to say, okay, what are the component parts of the portfolio? What can we value easily? Which is, the, you know, obviously the listed vehicles easily, but, you know, how do I look at the bits that haven't yet been listed or yet been monetized? And what does that come up with? And I think the value proposition, therefore, for investors is, and Rick again talked about this, what he cares about is, what is the net asset value per share of this company? What is the share price relative to that? And what if there is a big disconnect between the two? I'm either a buyer of the shares or a seller of them. And obviously, I think we're on here to argue that there is a big disconnect, because our share price is very significantly lower than what Charles estimates independently to be the net asset value per share. And that's the value proposition for shareholders. Now, if we can...
So, Sean, from a US perspective, what would attract US investors here? We're on off the charts here in the US. We're talking to US investors of all kinds. Why would they want to go and invest in Power Metal?
I think fundamentally, US investors are the same as, you know, all investors, you know, which is to say that the ones I've spoken to certainly recognize the importance of the energy transition and the opportunities that creates for investment. So, you know, we talk a lot about commodity markets, whether it's, you know, uranium, lithium, nickel, rare earths, PGEs, and so on, and the demand shock that the move to net zero is going to create. So how do I invest in that, number one? Secondly, how do I know that my investment's going to be safe and well managed? I think we offer that with a broad spread portfolio and a track record of delivering that. But also, I think the other thing is two other elements, which is, which jurisdictions are you in and do I feel comfortable investing there? And have you done the work in respect to all the rights of the ESG protocols and so on? And do I feel confident that the investment that I'm making is in the right areas and is being done in the right way? And I think we've got a very good track record on that as well. We operate in tier one jurisdictions, in Nevada, which obviously the US listeners will be very familiar with. Nevada is a tier one mining jurisdiction through our Golden Stroke Guardian Metals investment. Canada, obviously, we talked about Australia and Saudi Arabia and Oman, the Arabian Shield, which is going to be a major focus for the business going forward. These are all, and when we talk about Africa, specifically, we're talking about Botswana mainly. So these are all high quality jurisdictions where we're very confident in our ability to operate. And ESG credentials are also extremely good. And I've just come out of a very interesting meeting with a consultant that we're using to make sure that we are covering all of the important points for sustainability and so on in where we operate. So I think for US investors, what I'm offering you is a broad spread of commodity exposure, tier one geographies, a management with track record who do things the right way, and fundamentally make your money. And on a through cycle basis, we can demonstrate our ability to do that.
And currently, compared to US counterparts, this is probably ridiculously valued.
Well, I mean, we would obviously like to think so. I mean, Charles would tell you, I'm sure, that chief executives should spend less time talking about their share prices and more time talking about their operations, and we let the market do that. But since I'm here to promote the company, then yes, I do think that the market at the moment has us on a low valuation, which reflects a lot of things. Not just reflects our perception of our ability to execute. I think it reflects the fact that we're in a, hopefully coming to the end of what's been a pretty painful two-year bear market, in exploration and mining equity. So, I think we're coming out of that, and I think there are a lot of positive signals, but I think there is generally a disconnect. We're not the only ones, but I think that this is a great time to be investing in the sector, and I think we offer a very distinct proposition. And I think also that the incubator model we're talking about here, or what Rick Rule calls the merchant banking model, is very well understood in the US. This is something that I think people have seen before, where people, made money in the past. And here it is a good little outfit from across the pond who understand how that model works and can deliver great value.
Very good. Over to you, Charles, then. I mean, I think we talked before we started the podcast that there are maybe three main assets. Sorry, Guardian Metal Resources. Sorry, we're all flipping because we've been just going to gold in the last year, and now it's just changed its name to Guardian Metal Resources, which is a listed company. And if you listen to the podcast the last time around, you would have heard Oliver Friesen on that one talking everything about gold and metal resources. Then we've got the uranium prospects, and now the JV that's been done with that. And also you've got lots and lots and lots of other assets, and one of them being the ability to go into Saudi Arabia and all the mining and money that's being put into those jurisdictions. So the floor is yours, Charles.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that there is a theme. There's several themes running through Power Metal, but one of them is obviously proving this business model. Guardian Metal Resources, the assets within them were acquired for not that much. Maybe IPO was IPO'd at 8.5p a share or something like that. Was it 10p a share? Now this company has a £30 million market cap, and it really does prove that Power Metal has the ability to spin off these assets and generate real value creation. And it's the same with the Athabasca uranium assets. I mean, these are required for staking costs, and now obviously huge value generation there in the joint venture with ACAM. And then Power Arabia, where the corporate focus is, exactly the same. I mean, you've got this memorandum of understanding. It's really important with Saudi Arabia. Presumably more and more licenses you're going to lock up in the country.
Yes, that's right. And we've made a great start there. We've signed a fantastic deal with RIWAC, which is owned by EV Metals, people may be familiar with. And we've just completed our first field program there. And I wasn't there, I have to say, but in what I was told were extremely harsh conditions.
The heat must be.
I mean, these guys were, they really earned their money, these guys. And it was, very successful. We've set out some really interesting objectives there, and we've got some samples, which we're looking forward to talking more about. But there is a lot more to come. I mean, we've had some fantastic we spent, I think it was, we first went out there last September, I think it was. And we've had several trips there where we've been building relationships with the agreement that you mentioned there with the Ministry of Investment is very important because that's opened a lot of doors for us. But we're talking to a lot of people who are existing license holders who want our expertise and want our ability to bring these techniques that we've talked about and the incubator model. So there's two jobs to do with PowerArabia. One is to get access to the license areas. The other, obviously, is to get it funded. We're in the process of putting some really serious funding into that business, which I think, you know, is going to make us, you know, a very significant player in the region, because bringing in the incubator model is very appealing to investors locally. There's a huge impetus to build a mining industry in Saudi Arabia.
Of course there is. Yeah.
We're one of the ways that they can do that.
Well, this is the thing with Saudi, the Kingdom 2030 vision. This was put forward by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman back in 2016. You can split this into social reform and economic plans. I mean, I've gone into this in detail, but the basic point that you need to understand for Power Metal and PowerArabia is Saudi wants to reduce its dependence on oil, which is going to run out at some point. Now, the key thing with Saudi Arabia, there's plenty of money floating around, right? But the expertise to explore for these critical minerals like lithium, it lacks it. It feels like the country lacks it. So when power comes in, it brings the expertise. Saudi will bring the money, and hopefully there'll be fireworks. That seems to be generally the plan.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's important you touched on, you know, the point there about, you know, the oil and gas industry, because what that of course means in practice is that, you know, much of the infrastructure that you would need to operate in a jurisdiction like this is in place. You know, the grounding of, you know, permitting and, you know, licensing and the security of the contract, that, you know, the local partners, all the, you know, the involvement of the ministries. It's extremely joined up. It's very entrepreneurial. They're extremely commercial. They're very keen to have us there, you know, I've been in, you know, a number of meetings where the guys that we now know very well working in the ministries, you know, in the meeting, he will phone up his buddy at the other ministry and get things to happen. We've had people who've come on to us saying, we've been recommended. In fact, in an hour's time, I've got a call with one of them who came to us saying, look, we've been told by the ministry that your guys we should be dealing with. Let's work out how we can work together. We've got some licenses. We've got some investment. It's a very, very entrepreneurial commercial environment. It's extremely exciting. I mean, look, you know, as I've said on this call a few times, you know, I'm not a mining guy. I'm a finance guy. My job is to try and do these deals, get the best value for shareholders, and let the mining guys do their bit. Everybody here, you know, is excited about this. The geologists can't wait to get their hands on what is a highly prospective area. I'm excited about dealing with people who, you get, you know, they send the NDA back the same day, that, you know, they understand to do that. You know, all of that stuff, which is, you know, it sounds modest, but it's incredibly important. You know,
yeah, it is. Do you know the number of times that things get delayed because people, you know, it sits in your email box for months, you know, in some jurisdictions, and it's nobody's fault. Isn't it just wonderful? Like, Saudi Arabia is not just Power Metal. It feels like they're on top of things all the time, 24/7.
Yeah, yeah. And you're dealing with really, really good, you know, really good people. So we're very excited about it. And I think this has the potential to add tremendous value because, and you were kind of saying, the model works. We've seen that with GMET. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We're trying to bring the model that has successfully been executed into a jurisdiction which is very keen to have us and where the opportunity to just simply, you know, do what we do well is there. So I think it's going to drive a lot of value for us. And I'm sure that, you know, our current shareholders and hopefully new investors that are listening to this, you know, are going to see that, you know, as Rick Rule said, you know, you want to get in the ground floor, you create the ground floor yourself. And that's what PowerArabia.
Exactly that. Well, I mean, this probably almost certainly ties into the acquisition of GSA Environmental. I think you signed a memorandum of understanding with a Saudi Arabian supplier of fly ash. You call it a major Saudi Arabian supplier of fly ash. What's the plan there? Is the plan to build GSA-based plants in Saudi Arabia potentially in the future?
Yes. I mean, the important point about the fly ash is that it's, you know, it's highly enriched for a lot of critical metals. So fly ash, heavy fuel oil fly ash in particular, is very high grade for vanadium oxide. I mean, you're talking about, you know, 5-6% plus potentially from some of these samples. Now, this stuff, which is very important for vanadium redox batteries, is being mined very happily in Australia at, you know, a tenth of that grade. So, you know, it's a great opportunity not just to extract critical metals from waste product, but also to clear the waste itself. And of course, yeah. you know, for the Saudis, they generate a you know awful lot of this stuff, and they're very keen to deal with it. So
it's two birds, one stone, isn't it? You're making a profit, yeah. but you're getting rid of a problem for them.
Exactly. So yes, the process for us is to sign a contract, test the product for which we get paid to determine the content, the purity,
yeah.
to then subsequently build pilot plants and then ultimately put an actual processing plant on site. Now that the opportunity there for us clearly is revenue, and to have a long term royalty arrangement, it also brings in potentially other investors alongside the private equity guys who are able to deploy the sort of sums that you need for kind of plant building. So this is not something that we're going to be coming to shareholders and saying we need 30, 40 million or something. It's,
well, I hope not, because you're not going to get it.
We're partnering with with major investors to deliver that. But for Power Metal shareholders, the GSA is an almost free option. I mean,
I worked out. Yeah, genuinely. It almost is, isn't it? But I mean, in terms of, it does feel like with GSA or even, the Athabasca Uranium Joint Venture, Guardian Metal Resources spin-off, the option agreement over Tati, New Horizon Metals deal with Rumour, the disposal of Victoria Goldfield's interest to Red Rock, all of these things, it feels like you're rebalancing the corporate portfolio so you can focus on Power Arabia without having these disparate elements kind of taking up both your money in terms of corporate money, but your time.
That's right. And I think, we've said for some time, that we want to focus the portfolio on where we think we can make the best returns. Where it makes, and to decide, does it make sense to own an asset 100% and bear all the costs? Does it make more sense perhaps to be a 30% shareholder and have a freebie on somebody else's investment? And I think, if you forgive me for special pleading, I mean, that's the hard part, or the clever part, if you will, which is how do we construct the portfolio so that we can maximize those returns? Where do we allocate our capital, our time, and bandwidth? It's not just a question of saying, right, we've got all these assets, let's find a deal for them and, get them off.
And move on, yeah.
It's more about, in some cases, we'll want to maintain a majority. In some cases, we're content with a relatively small ownership. So that's the secret sauce, if you like, is the ability to manage the portfolio. And that's where I would hope that there would be some value, for us. Yeah. It's just a simple question of saying, what are some of the parts of all the assets? It's also what is the ability of the company to execute on those.
Exactly that.
And to add value.
Well, this is the thing, right? Because the value of the land is one thing, but if you're not developing it, then it's a parcel of land doing nothing, right? So, yeah. And this is the thing, regardless of whether it's something that's maybe not so prospective or something which is hugely prospective, you're getting deals through on various lines, which is really encouraging. I mean, again, I think the ACAM JV on the Athabasca uranium assets is, a key example. So we'll talk about Guardian Metal in a moment. But originally you planned to do the uranium energy exploration IPO and vend some of your assets into an IPO. Presumably, while you were doing that, ACAM came along and said, look, we want to get involved in all of these properties. And
yeah.
That sort of start out.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we had a well sort of developed plan. In fact, we were a long way down the road with an IPO with a potential cornerstone investor, and that was all going along very nicely. And we through some of our key advisors, we took the idea in to see those guys, and they said, well, hang on, look, maybe there's another deal to be done here, because we're very interested in uranium. They come at it from a slightly different angle to most people, that it's more about the demand shock from driven by data centers and AI and what have you, or the need for this sort of clean transition energy, as a simply just the we've got to decarbonize the grid.
That's, yeah,
well, part of it, but there's an additional element, and but we wanted to deploy quite a big chunk of capital. So what about a deal for the bigger portfolio? Now, clearly, what we had to consider was what's best for shareholders. And is it better for us to be, whatever the number would have been, somewhere between, 45 and 50% of what would have been UEE, which would have had three or four assets in it? Or is it better for us to be a 30% shareholder of the entire portfolio with somebody else paying for the exploration? Well, it wasn't a very long conversation, to be honest.
That's a no-brainer to me.
Yeah, it was very clearly in the better interest of Power shareholders to do this bigger deal. Now, obviously, that means we have to do some unwinding of the UEE process, and obviously there's some you know, some investors in there who we need to you know, to unwind and everything. We're working on that at the moment. But fundamentally, you know, for the power shareholders, you know, this is a fantastic deal.
And I think, yeah, I mean, it's just before you continue, it's worth pointing out, because the thing in your mind, you know, ACAM, I know ACAM, but people don't realize how, you know, important this company is just to the wider sector. Amaroq Minerals, they're the JV partner for the Gardaq JV, huge strategic mineral package in Greenland, which is, you know, analogous potentially to Voisey's Bay across the sea. They're also helped out in the early days at Jubilee Metals, which, you know, has huge control over African chrome, PGMs, copper in Zambia. So, you know, it's the fact that Power, which has, you know, currently marching along with, say, a £20 million market capitalization, has attracted ACAM into this portfolio. That's massive in a way that, you know, you potentially maybe take for granted on some level because it's just part and parcel of what you do. But outside investors should realize it's a big deal.
Yeah, and I'm delighted you say that because, yeah, look at it, you know, it is. And they also, I mean, we haven't completed the deal. Just important for people to understand that, you know, that deal is still
in the works. Yeah.
But, you know, obviously, we're very confident that that's going to happen whilst obviously giving no guarantee on it. But we have also, however, have executed, you know, a £2 million loan note, which has already... It was already gone in, but that's already happened, which hopefully underpins, you know, ACAM's confidence, obviously, that they are going to execute and that they are, you know, keen on us and keen to, you know, help progress things. So, yeah, look, it's a really important relationship. It also has helped us across the board bringing in, you know, other advisors that we want to work with. And I think generally it moves us a little bit up the curve, if you like, the value curve in terms of being taken seriously. And it gives us, you know, as you've said, you know, something to really sort of, you know, market the company with. If we're attracting the likes of Rick Rule, attracting the likes of ACAM, then, you know, hopefully that will bring in a lot of interest from some investors who have seen that success that you've talked about. What it did for the Amaroq share price, I did a bit of work for those guys, you know, a couple of years ago.
And everybody knows everyone in this space.
Yeah, fantastic guys, great team, amazing assets. You know, I really, really enjoyed my time with them. And, you know, and it's been hugely beneficial to their share price. So hopefully some of that rubs off onto us, I think.
Well, you should hope so, shouldn't you? I mean, this is the thing, right? Because as an if you're an outside investor looking in, I released a huge note on mining.co.uk that, you know, there's 40 pages. I can tell you that regardless of any kind of growth, the net asset value of what you have is at least double what your current market capitalization is. But beyond that, you need to look at Guardian Metal Resources and the amount of capital, you know, value add you've created there. This joint venture, you know, these uranium licenses, they were for staking costs only, weren't they, when they were originally staked by the former CEO. I mean, in terms of the acquisition costs, that's pennies. And now you have a JV that's worth this amount of money. And therefore, when I'm looking at Power Arabia, subjectively, you're saying, hang on, well, they've managed to do this with Guardian Metal. They've managed to do it with the Athabasca Uranium. And Sean is now saying, this is where the corporate focus is. Hopefully there'll be huge value creation there as well, and that will get reflected in the share price once people realize what you're doing here.
Yeah, and that's right. And I think, you know, with Power Arabia and with, you know, with obviously FDR to come as well, inevitably there's going to be always a little bit of arbitrage, isn't there? You know, the people are going to say, well, you know, I love bacon, but I prefer the whole fry up, you know. And, you know, I want to own the parent. On the other hand, there are people who say, well, I really like GMET or I really like FDR, so I'm going to focus my attention on that. And that's partly why, you know, the liquidity in the shares is very important. Being on exchanges like OTC, where there is a, you know, broad constituency of potential investors, to create the liquidity in the shares that's so important. If we're very restricted just to the AIM market, then you're always going to suffer a little bit from this arbitrage. And then people are going to say, well, I'm going to sell some Power Metal because I like GBET. Yeah, and that's a perfectly understandable and acceptable, you know, philosophy. But what we've got to do is say, okay, well, you know, we need to find more investors there. We need to find, you know, a broader constituency. And that's why the OTC is extremely important for us to be able to get our message across, but also to make it easier for people to buy shares. I think any American investor is telling you that there's lots of very sexy companies on AIM, but it's difficult to buy them, you know, with the app or whatever. I
mean, it's a nightmare without the OTC listing.
Give up, don't you? So, you know, you get nowhere if you don't make it as easy as you possibly can for investors to actually invest. And I think that, you know, that's what we're doing with OTC. That's why we're very grateful to you know, to Kev and Phil for having us on to appeal directly to that audience. And that's why we're going to RIT Rules Symposium, you know, be one-on-one with OTC investors, because, you know, it's very important that for the valuation gap to close, which we obviously hope it will, that, you know, we find that constituency who are interested in doing that.
Well, the last conference, you went to RIT Rule last year as well, didn't you?
Yeah.
But you had no OTC listing at the time, if I'm right.
That's right. You know, it took a bit of time.
Well, it does. I'm not blaming you.
Right. And we had some really, you know, we did have some people buying shares and, you know, we had a lot of support. I mean, I've done investor relations for a long time. And, you know, typically the first time people meet you, they've obviously never heard of you. The second time they meet you, they might remember you. The third time they might ask you a question. You know, it's...
Almost sounds like you're running a restaurant almost. The first, second, yeah. Third visit. Yeah.
Exactly.
I guess if anyone's going down, Sean, they can reach out to you and maybe arrange to meet you down there. Is that possible?
Zen, absolutely. And you know, we're very happy to take direct messages and arrange to do that. There's a website where you can make appointments. But also the other thing is that whilst there are, I don't know, 700 or 800 people in the conference itself, which is pretty big for an event like this, there are thousands online who subscribe through the Rule Investment Media channel who, you know, we were able to interact online. So we're very keen, obviously, to be able to do that as well. The online audience is enormous. So we hope that we can reach a lot of people. We hope that the message we've got is very clear, very easy to understand, and that the shares are relatively easy to buy now that we have that OTC access.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair as well. I imagine I know this is true. If I find it difficult to buy a share that I think is good value, I'll hunt them down because that's what I do. But for a lot of retail investors, that's not the case, is it? And while now you're on the OTC, it should be as simple as open the app, whatever app you have, click buy, and that's it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and just remind me, what's the power metal, the ticker on the OTC market?
BOWMF.
Excellent, wonderful. Well, Sean, do you know, it's been lovely chatting. You know, I haven't chatted, well, not actually in person, but I haven't chatted to you in person in a long time. You seem, I would say, sort of in the past year or so, where the share price hasn't gone where we'd hope it might go, the value creation and the corporate rebalancing has been really, really impressive. What you inherited was a really kind of like this disparate land package, which had a huge amount of value. And now you're starting, you've unlocked a lot of it. And I'm just hopeful, you know, really hopeful that you'll go to this conference group rule over the next, and you know, it's 7th to the 11th of July, and people will just say, look, this company is going places. It's going places in Saudi Arabia. It's going places in Nevada. It's going places in Athabasca. It's going places in Botswana. I wouldn't mind having a quick chat about Molopo briefly, because obviously that was, you know, I wouldn't personally say it's the flagship anymore of the company, given the other assets that you have going. But you drilled a drill hole and you came back with VSA. What's the plan there? Are we talking to other parties in the area?
Yes. And look, you know, it's a tricky one. It always has been. You know, this is a very, very large license area with a potentially district scale asset. We've always said that. And I think you made a very interesting comment, you know, on one of the chats. You know, a lot of people debating is, you know, at this point, is it really a flagship? Is it interesting? Are they ever going to get there? Have they even actually got anything? And I think you said, well, I think they've certainly gone into something, but the question is how much drilling they're able to do to actually establish it.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, this is a major project. You know, we did one drill hole of roughly about 800 meters specifically to intercept a conductor, a sharply dipping conductor, which we did. We've identified, you know, a number of sort of geological features which give us more confidence of the potential for a major nickel sulfide deposit. But you need a lot more holes, and therefore you need a lot more money spent, and therefore you need to do a deal with somebody who recognizes the potential and wants to do that. Now, you know, it's very important not to set expectations here and to say, you know, we're about to announce something that's going to give you that. We do have regular conversations with lots of different people about what we could do with Molopo. I think what I would say really is I wouldn't be guiding shareholders that we're going to spend a lot more money in the short to medium term doing what we've been doing, which is, you know, a relatively small scale program to sort of further prove the asset. I think
you've proven you've got something worth. I mean, the most recent RNS suggests that there is evidence there could potentially be a magmatic sulfide deposit which, you know, for nickel is the gold standard. It's similar to rutile for titanium or spodumene for lithium, or it's what you want to find. But again, you need to put, you know, however many holes into the ground in that land package, costing however many millions of dollars. And I guess the question for you is, you know, obviously there will be interested parties, but, you know, going back to that earlier conversation, what's the trade-off, essentially? You know, how much of the asset do you give away in return for exploration spend that you don't have to, you know, worry about? And I obviously, that's for you as a CEO to decide. But I think you've now come to a point where you can't put more money into the ground yourself.
No, I think that's right. And I think that, you know, we have got lots of other things that are very interesting. I think people have realized that, you know, we never were a one trick pony, but, you know, the dependence, if you like, on Malopo has been, you know, substantially reduced. It's still, a very interesting asset with a fantastic potential. But to advance it from here is going to require that additional capital, and that's going to come with a joint venture partnership or some sort of corporate action, which is going to unlock that. And that's the focus. And I think, you know, hopefully we've been clear about that in the recent RNS. And I think everything we have done at Malopo has advanced our understanding and has been successful in that sense. But the major commercial discovery that we all want is going to depend on substantial investment. So it's a question of how we do that.
That happen.
Yeah. And I'm hopefully being able to talk about that more as we progress that.
Okay, Sean, I will take the field. So you have lots of children in this power metal resources portfolio. So if you had to choose, let's say, one or two children that would be worth $100 million in the next, let's give you a 3-year time period, which would it be?
Well, I think... Yeah, we're both parents, aren't we? And, you know, we would therefore say, you know, we love all our children equally. I think that, you know, GMET has already demonstrated, you know, that it can stand on its own 2 feet. It's growing incredibly well. Oliver's done an outstanding job, not just in terms of operationally, but, you know, how he communicates the story, how he's attracted investors, how he's, you know, delivered relative to expectations. So I think that one's well on its way to, you know, continue to you know, create value.
Yeah, GMET is now not a baby anymore. It's a young child.
Like a grown adult.
It's left the nest, you know, really. I think that, you know, where are you looking for, you know, the big pockets of hidden value? You know, Athabasca, we've established a certain amount of value, and I think that, you know, it's quite easy, you know, and looking at Charles' work to be able to say, okay, what do you've turned, you know, maybe 1 million or so into, say, 10 million or so, not quite precise numbers, but that's kind of given the sort of quantum. And so, we can hang our hats on that. But what's next? Well, what's next is, you know, the high potential now, I would say, for commercial discovery. And of course, you know, in uranium, that's extremely valuable. So I think there's a lot of value to come over and above what we've already done there. Arabia, well, I mean, look, the sky's slightly the limit there. You know, we're talking about, you know, being involved in, you know, multiple relationships with companies that have themselves got multiple licenses. So there is a lot of potential for us to get into very serious large scale projects that could go beyond just the simple exploration and then monetization. You know, a lot of the relationships we're talking about here are slightly more complex in terms of, we want to build a mine, you know, we want you to be in this for the long term. So the value creation potential there is huge. GSA, which we've only really touched on, I think, you know, I don't want to set high expectations for, but...
Yeah, GSA is an intriguing one. I mean, if I had to put you on the spot, say 2 years from now, can GSA provide you the revenue to completely run our metal resources?
Yeah, 100%. The potential is there to do exactly that. And that's exactly, and I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly why, you know, we bought it. I think the GSA could be a very exciting standalone IPO business ultimately, but that's obviously somewhere in the future. I think, you know, what I would like to develop is a cash generative business that funds the group. I mean, at the moment, 75% of it. And this is just, I mean, I'm sure we probably want to finish, but this is a really important point going back to what we talked about at the beginning, is what is the model? I take your capital, I invest it, I make money, and I return it to you in hopefully the form of a much higher share price. That's the merchant bank. Now, how do I get that capital? Well, I can keep coming back to you. And what's been the experience over the last couple of years is that obviously that cost of capital has been very high. Now, if I don't have to keep coming back to the market and I can generate capital myself, then that's all the better for shareholders. And that's our objective. So we want to have a sustainable business model where we create revenue, not just through asset disposal ultimately, but through positive cash flow. And I think if we can do that, then this really is a very, very interesting proposition, a value proposition for shareholders. Because one of the things that holds companies like us back is, look, I've listened to your podcast, this is all very lovely, but you're probably going to be raising money again in 6 months, so why don't I invest then? Because it's probably going to be a bit cheaper. Well, if we can move away from that sort of, you know, that cycle of equity dilution, which I think we can, then I think we offer something that's very, very different to what perhaps people regard as the usual exploration model.
Yeah, and you do have the potential, I think, to sell a smaller stake in GMET, for instance, and have a liquidity event, which will allow you also to plan for 2-3 year period. I don't mean the whole of Guardian Metal Resources, but a 10% stake to another institutional investor. Again, not now necessarily, because there's a lot of drivers that are still there and available with Guardian Metal over the next even 6 months, I think, which should drive the share price higher. So, yeah. No, I think if you are an investor, you don't have the time or the patience to look at individual projects over and over again and be up to date with all of these things, then this model, the fact that Power Metal Resources is massively undervalued from a net asset value point of view, then this has got to be a good option for your investments.
Yes, I agree with you, and I, you know, I think there's always going to be a place in, and I'm sure we all run our individual portfolios, don't we, where, you know, you've got some fantastic, this could happen, and if it does, it's going to be 100 times more money, but could be nothing. And
yes, exactly.
You know, we love those. We're not, you know.
Well, you only love them if it's the first 20.
Bring you 11 different goes at it, you know, but it's a diversified bet on that same sort of dynamic. You know, fundamentally, we're an explorer. We want to make big discoveries now, but we're doing it across lots and lots of different things. So it's, but, you know, if I can produce a company that is making you a very, you know, paying you, I mean, ultimately, you know, if we're paying you a dividend yield and you've got exposure to the discovery, that is, for me, that's a very exciting prospect.
And from the point of view of GSA, what time frame are we looking at if it comes to fruition? Obviously, because there are obviously things that might make this not happen, but it looks pretty probable. But yeah, what time frame are we talking about?
Well, we have, you know, we set out, you know, in the heads of terms, you know, for that business, what the current or the previous owners will get paid out, you know, under certain sort of profit scenarios, and you know, that shows, I think, that you know, what the prospects for this business are. I mean, we're what I would say is, without getting expectations really too out of control, is, you know, we are at the moment, you know, we're working very hard on, you know, a number of potential contracts. We are looking forward to being able to update soon on those. And there is there's a lot of work going on. So it's not something that's necessarily very, very short term, but it's equally not a long way off in the future either. I think you talked about, you know, 1 or 2 years for that business to be generating good returns. And I think that's, you know, that's a fairly safe assumption at this point. It could accelerate, you know, we could be sooner, but we are very confident in the team there and in the technology, and also in our ability through our network that we've created in particularly Saudi Arabia, but also elsewhere to bring a lot of business into GSA. So there's a big synergy between us and them. You know, they bring the technology and the track record of this extractive procedures. We bring capital, and we bring a network of potential customers for that product. So we'll be saying a lot more about it. It'll be a big generator of news, and I'm hoping that it'll outperform both our expectations and also hopefully what we said in the market.
So Sean, you're on Off the Charts, run by the Sunday Roast and the OTC. We ask you this question: what is your favorite movie?
That's a very good question, actually. And my son and I have, you know, he's a big movie fan, and he's been given a poster by a friend of his, which means you have to scratch off all that's like the top 100 movies.
Wow, that sounds brilliant.
Yeah, once you watch them all, you know, you're kind of up to speed. And one of the top ones that he came home and said he needed to watch was The Godfather.
Oh, that's great.
We sat down and watched that, and his
Scorsese, yeah.
Yeah, I was reminded how much I enjoyed that, and I'd say that's probably one of my. I'm not sure whether it necessarily sends a particular message for the investment case.
I thought you were going to say Scarface.
You got any? Italian descent, Sean, or not?
Well, I think maybe if we could kind of tie it in. The opening line, the Godfather, people might remember, is the chap saying, "I believe in America," and I think the purpose of perhaps the podcast is to appeal to a US audience. But we're all joking aside. I honestly do believe that US investors understand the hyper business model. Fully understand the challenges the world faces and how to invest in that, and I think we're delivering a great solution to those issues and an opportunity for investors to make a lot of money. So to the extent I do believe in the US, and I believe very strongly in US investors' understanding of this sector, and I hope that we're going to be able to benefit from that and deliver a lot of great returns for them.
As long as we're not waking up with a horse's head on the pillow, I think we'll all be happy at that point. So
yep,
I'll say on that note, Sean Wade, CEO of Power Metal Resources, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
We've seen an increase in the value of gold in dollars, and obviously the dollar has also decreased slightly as well. So we've been in a situation where the price of gold across the world has increased quite a lot in a short period of time. What's your thoughts on that, guys?
Well, I think there's three stores of value, right? There's gold, which has been, again, an inflationary hedge for millennia. There's the US dollar that's been around for, a couple of hundred years. And then there's Bitcoin, which is relatively new. Now, I would venture Bitcoin, even now is not worth, particularly much when you're talking in the context of the global markets. So you have gold and the US dollar. If you're looking for somewhere safe to park, billions and billions of dollars, pounds, whatever currency you're using. And the US dollar, the deficit, is a huge, huge growing problem. They keep printing more and more money. And when Trump gets into power, he's going to print more. And even if the Democrats get into power, they'll print more. There will come a point where they'll need to deal with that problem. And it's not that gold is becoming more valuable. It's that the fiat currency is becoming less valuable. Gold, one gold bar is just worth one gold bar and always has been. A kilo of gold is worth a kilo of gold. And its value in dollar terms is determined both, economic growth, essentially. Is it better to invest in equities or gold, for example? But on top of that, if you're going to have somewhere safe to put your money, is the US dollar safer than gold at the moment? No. And the other problem with it as well is that the reason gold keeps rising, we've got this AI bubble in the US with these companies of multi-trillion, Nvidia's, multi-trillion dollar valuation, it's worth multiples of every major mining company in the world, right? And so we have this position where if you are risk averse, you're looking at, you're going, the AI bubble is going to pop. So I can't put my money into equities. I can't put my money into US dollars. Where's it going to go? It's going to go into gold. It's just a very attractive place to keep your money safe.
Yeah. So, I mean, are you looking at any specific ETFs when you do? Are we talking, would you invest in physical gold, or are we talking like a gold ETF or something like that, Charles?
So in the UK, and I imagine there'll be something similar in the US, so I don't know, to be honest. But if you buy physical gold coins from the Royal Mint, they're free of VAT and capital gains tax. So there's a huge tax advantage of just buying the physical gold itself. In terms of like ETFs, ETCs, there's the Invesco ETC ETF holds gold bars in the JP Morgan vault in London, and it's backed one-to-one gold to gold. So it's a very popular way to just hold it. And then, other ways you can invest in gold is through gold miner ETFs. I'd argue, given how high gold is and how low the major gold miners, the juniors as well, but the majors too, all the miners are very undervalued compared to the value of gold at the moment. And you can see this in, if you go back, a lot of mines being built or operating at the moment, they're profitable based on gold prices of like $1,700, $1,800, $1,900 an ounce. Yeah. And we're now at like $2,500 an ounce a couple of years later, and it's still rising.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Interesting. I wanted to just get your take on, before we wrap up for the day, just on the S&P performance. I was listening to an interesting podcast with a guy called Scott Galloway, and he's a professor of marketing at the New York Stern School of Business. And he was talking to Stephen Bartlett on the Diary CEO, talking about how he would invest money. And he was saying that in his experience, and he's a multimillionaire, he was saying that all the people that he thinks you could trust in the finance space, none of them know what they're talking about. But he said, if you want like steady compound growth or compound interest, investing in the S&P, like a trust like Vanguard or something like that, which tracks the sort of the Magnificent Seven, and there's investments in NVIDIA, and it effectively tracks the performance of the S&P. Do you think that's a good idea to invest sort of $1,000 a month into that and grow into it each month?
I mean, I've always invested in the S&P 500 in my pension, just because since 1957, average annual return, 11% a year.
Yeah.
In terms of risk off asset, it's difficult to beat that. And yet I've withdrawn most of my capital from the US now, simply because I think that these bubble valuations are insane and it's going to pop. I don't know when, you know, I think this is the thing. It could, the party can keep going for a while, but it will pop eventually. Now, I mean, if you're talking about Galloway in particular, you know, I in 2015, he said that Macy's would beat out Amazon, right? And then lost 3/4 of its value, and Amazon went, you know, a gazillion fold higher. He also said that Tesla stock would collapse and shrink sort of 80-90%. And it didn't. Musk, you know, if you look at Tesla, one of the most successful investments of the past few years, even after the fall, you know, recently. So it's potentially, you know, he calling the big shots, he hasn't got it right in the past. But I think with the S&P 500, the key thing is passive investing. We're all in active investing, right? So we're picking stocks often, and we're sort of like jumping in and out. I know, for example, that many of my siblings are investing in their ISAs and SIPs in the S&P 500. And every month they put a few £100, £1,000, whatever, into that index or an index tracker tracking the S&P 500. So, and they don't care. They don't care if it goes up or down. They're not even paying attention. It just goes in. And I imagine you guys might be the same on some level as well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's always been an interesting one. I just, you know, I wish I knew what I know now when I was 18, because ultimately I would have put more into that sort of investment side of things. Obviously, it's easier said than done. You've got lack of income. But I think if you can grow, if you look at compound interest, like 18 to sort of 45, and you were putting a good amount each month into the S&P, something like Vanguard or SPY as it's called, then yeah, you would do extremely well out of it. You know, you could take probably tens of thousands of dollars into £1 million, right, by the time you're 40, 45.
Well, okay, right. So in the UK, we have something called a junior ISA. You have a very similar account in the US where you can invest tax-free on behalf of your children up to like a certain amount. Over here, it's £9,000 a year. I think it's something similar in the US. Effectively, it's designed to get you, often you'll use, you know, college saving accounts in the US, right? Now, here's the context. Let's say you've got two children, which is the most popular number of children to have, both in the UK and the US, and you automatically deposit £50 a month into their accounts from birth and get an annual return of 10%, which is less than what the S&P 500 is. After 18 years, when they're 18, they'll have about £30,000, $30,000 each, right? When they're 21, they'll have about $42,000 each. And at 25, they'll have $66,000 each. So you're talking, you know, $50 or £50 a month. Most people can afford to do that. And then you set them up for life.
And you imagine if you did that at 500 a month, Charles?
Well, oh, my God,
numbers,
yeah.
Numbers are staggering.
Well, I think, okay, here's a classic one for you. So if you invest £3,500 into your child's pension at birth, and then do that again, year two, year three, or just £10,000 lump sum, after 65 years, they'll have $10 million.
Yeah.
So yes, there's inflation. But I think one of the big problems is you only start investing in your 30s, generally. That's most people. If you invest on behalf of your children when they're born, they get 30 extra years of compounding. And yeah,
you can most people, when they get cash payday, they'll go and buy a big screen TV rather than putting it into an investment, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, most people will, but you know, hopefully not people on this podcast. But I think one of the big things with kids is, and in America, it's even more acute than in the UK, you can't just kick them out at 18 anymore and hope that they'll be fine. They need capital to go to college or to buy a house or to get married or whatever else. So, and if you don't prepare for that, what will happen is they'll be living with you. So if you don't want to have that in old age, then you've got to help them out. You've got to save some.
I think that's a good time as any to wrap things up. Thank you for listening. And we obviously thank Sean Wade, CEO of Power Metals, for coming on and talking to us about the compelling investment that is Power Metal Resources. It trades under the ticker POWMF on the OTCQB. Please subscribe if you like what you've heard, and hit the bell icon for any future notifications of any further episodes.